This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Anti-globalization protesters have taken to the streets in recent years, condemning international financial institutions like the World Trade Organization as tools of multinational corporations. But some activists have come to feel differently about James Wolfensohn, the charismatic and controversial man who took over as president of the World Bank in 1995. Wolfensohn championed the cause of debt relief for third world nations, condemned the corruption of authoritarian regimes, and opened a dialogue with activist groups. But he's also made enemies inside and outside the bank. Wolfensohn's turbulent ride at the World Bank is the subject of a book by my guest, Sebastian Malaby. Malaby is a columnist for The Washington Post who's covered world development problems for years. He's written most recently about foreign policy issues in the presidential campaign. His book about James Wolfensohn is called The World's Banker. The World Bank lends hundreds of billions of dollars for projects in developing countries. I asked Malaby how it funds its projects.
Well, it does it partly by borrowing the money itself on Wall Street and elsewhere, and then on lending it to poorer countries who might have trouble borrowing the money directly themselves. And that was the original conception when the World Bank was set up in 1944, when the Second World War was still going on. The concept was that poor countries, or even at that time, sort of war-torn Europe, which needed to be reconstructed after the war, would not have the credit worthiness to borrow on the capital markets. So you would need a development bank to get in the middle, to be the borrower on Wall Street and then on lend to the poor countries. But there's a second way it channels money as well, and that is by getting donations from a wide range of richer governments who every 3 years put money into its kitty, and then that subsidizes the World Bank to lend at a very charitable rate, which is effectively three-quarters grant, to the very poor countries who couldn't afford to borrow on the commercial terms.
Now, what was the bank's image in the developing world and among these nonprofit activist organizations who follow it? What was the bank's reputation when Wolfensohn took over in the mid-90s?
Well, that's right. Jim Wolfensohn came to the World Bank in 1995, and just 1 year before, there'd been the 50th anniversary of the World Bank's founding, which was marked in Madrid, Spain, at the annual meetings of the World Bank, which turned into what, although we didn't have the word then, the anti-globalization movement, but effectively that's what hit the World Bank in Madrid that year. There were huge street protests all across Madrid and the old town. People were handing out fake dollar bills saying, you know, World Frankenstein, and, you know, this bill can be redeemed for environmental destruction. So we had, you know, we're familiar now with the Seattle anti-globalization protests, which then spread to the World Bank in 2000 and to other targets like the World Trade Organization and the G7 summit. And that was in 1999-2000. But before that, 5 years earlier, the World Bank had come under the same kind of attack. And that was against the background against which Jim Wolfensohn took over. And his tenure over the last 9 years has been a sort of case study in the question, can a big international organization like the World Bank or any of the other big ones, can it make peace with these activists out there in the street who for one reason or another don't like it?
Give us an example of the kind of project which earned the activists condemnation.
Well, there were a couple of classic cases in the early 80s. One was Polo Noroeste, which was a development project in Amazonia in Brazil, where the World Bank supported a project to sort of build roads into the Amazon and develop it. And although there were various protections built in, there were kind of wildlife reserves and so forth, it was implemented badly and caused enormous amounts of environmental destruction in the Amazon. And that really motivated environmental movements, particularly in the United States, to get active, to go out there, take evidence, take photographs, and come back to Washington with the evidence that the World Bank was harming the people that it was supposed to be helping.
Now, I gather that the previous president, Lewis Preston, had a reputation for ignoring this criticism. I mean, their letters would go unanswered, and he never deigned to have any interaction. Give us a sense of Jim Wolfensohn and sort of the personality and history he brought to the job and how that might have been different from previous presidents.
Well, that's right. I mean, there was a bit of one of the themes that comes up in my book is the way that the World Bank's shifts mirror shifts in the broader society, in politics, and in thinking. And so just as in 1992, the United States experienced an election in which sort of a patrician, East Coast, slightly buttoned-down figure of George Bush Sr. Lost the election to a kind of charismatic communicator who felt everybody's pain, Bill Clinton. In the same way, the World Bank went through a similar transition in 1995 when Lew Preston, who was very much in the George Bush Sr. mold of a kind of tight-lipped, bad communicator, stumbled over his words, hated the bully pulpit, gave way to this sort of person who wanted to be loved by everybody, Jim Wolfensohn, who was a natural communicator and loved nothing better than, you know, going off to a village in Africa and sitting under a tree in a village with a village chief and discussing life with him. And so this was an entirely new style of leadership which really shook the World Bank up.
Your book focuses mostly on how effectively he and the World Bank coped with these issues, but he's an interesting character in himself. I mean, he was a concert cellist, an Olympic fencer. Just tell us a little bit about his history.
Well, that's right. He grew up in relative obscurity in Australia and made it via the City of London, where he worked in banking in the 1960s and 70s, to Wall Street, where he not only led the bailout of the Chrysler car company at the end of the 1970s, but then founded his own firm, which went on to make hundreds of millions of dollars. And he himself amassed a fortune of well over $100 million. And then he was also, as you say, an accomplished musician. He took up the cello when he was nearly 40, but he still played on the stage of Carnegie Hall on his 50th birthday with the likes of Yo-Yo Ma, and did it again on his 60th birthday and his 70th birthday, which I went to last year. And so he has this amazing musical accomplishment. He also represented his country, Australia, in the Olympics in 1956 and continued to be an amazing sportsman thereafter. And he really is one of the most extraordinary networkers. He has a golden Rolodex which spans the world and ranges from, in Hollywood, you know, people like Harrison Ford to, on the other side of the world, the Dalai Lama. The network is quite extraordinary.
So he uses that network, in effect, to lobby for this job, lobby President Clinton, and gets it in 1995. He begins with a trip to Africa. Tell us about that first trip that Jim Wolfensohn took to Africa, who he met with, the importance of the kind of the steps he took on that trip.
Well, he set off almost immediately after becoming president of the World Bank, and most people were telling him, no, you shouldn't go out into the field immediately. You need to spend some time at headquarters kind of understanding the organization. But he made it clear that the clients of the World Bank, the poor countries that were borrowing from it, actually mattered to him more than whatever was going on within his headquarters. So he went off, and his first country he went to was Mali, an incredibly poor country in the Sahel. And rather than just meeting with the president and the prime minister, which he did do, he also went off to a village and sat under a tree with the village chief and, ate the local nuts that he was given and was saluted by some muskets firing in the sky. And he sort of drank in the whole color of the occasion. He went to, you know, slums and talked to people that he met there. And he clearly just reacted wonderfully to the hospitality of the people he met. He connected with them on a human level. And that did transform the image of the World Bank, which had been seen as a sort of, you know, hard-faced, steely-eyed debt collector for a long time in Africa. And it showed that this was a World Bank that wanted to reach out and to be different and to really help people to understand their problems and not to just dictate that they should, you know, close their budget deficits or control inflation.
One of the things that he learned in Mali was the importance of the country directors for the World Bank to live in and be involved with the countries that they were directing assistance to. And you write a good bit about Uganda and how it was regarded in some respects as a success story of a different kind of development, maybe one in which World Bankers listen more closely to and learn from the priorities of that country. Tell us about Uganda and what it tells us about development.
Well, yes, Uganda is a fascinating story. I mean, we've heard of development successes in East Asia. We know that the Asian tigers have made an amazing leap out of poverty in the last generation. But what's perhaps less known is that a country in the heart of Africa, Uganda, cut the poverty rate by 40% in the 1990s. And so if you ask the question, well, how did that happen and what did the World Bank contribute? You know, you can certainly find things that the World Bank did. The World Bank had technical experts who went and gave good advice at certain key points, which enabled the Ugandan government to do its job better. But really the key to putting Uganda on the right track was that there happened to be this extraordinary character who I write about a fair bit in my book, who was a sort of Ugandan technocrat, a sort of enormous guy, well over 6 foot tall, you know, big, strong, booming voice, hard-drinking character, who just told the foreigners who came to give advice to Uganda, you know, if he didn't agree with it, he just told them to get lost. And he drove the agenda. He owned the agenda. He didn't let foreign aid donors tell him what to do.
His name was Emmanuel. Help me with the pronunciation.
Yes, he's called. He has a long name. He's called Emmanuel Tumusiimi Mutebile. And his position at first was that he was sort of the chief technocrat, not a government minister, but the sort of top guy, a civil servant underneath him, in one of the two or three different economics ministries. And when President Museveni took power in Uganda in 1986, initially pursued a rather sort of classic statist program of nationalizing things and directing prices from the capital and so on. And this guy, Emmanuel Tumusiimi Mutebile, said to him, "Mr. President, your plan is going to fail completely. So I'm going to ignore what you're telling me. I'm going to go create my own economic plan, which will work. And when you realize that your one is no good, you can come to me and I'll have the plan ready." And because indeed the president's plan did fail totally within about 12 months, he did turn to this technocrat, who from then on, you know, his word was always listened to. And so therefore he had the political backing of the president to drive a program of reform of things like liberalizing coffee prices, which allowed poor farmers who grew coffee suddenly to actually get the benefit of their crops rather than having it siphoned off by an inefficient government marketing board, which, you know, pocketed most of the profits. He did reforms like this, and it did cut poverty in Uganda by 40%. And the lesson for the international community, for the donors, and I think for, you know, American foreign aid policy too, is that development really works. Countries really lift themselves out of poverty when the government in place wants to do it. You can't force them to do it from the outside.
You know, one of the critiques of the World Bank is that it is essentially run by the large developing nations, principally the United States, and the view is that their governments are heavily influenced by multinational corporate interests, and that therefore the World Bank is essentially an agent of international corporations. To what extent are decisions about development projects in the World Bank, do you believe, influenced by specific corporate interests? Say, a company that wants to mine aluminum or expand coffee production, and maybe they get the World Bank to build the railroad or the highway they need to open a new market.
Yes, you're right. That is a common perception. I mean, I think in general, you know, blaming the World Bank for sort of entrenching global poverty by siding with corporations is a bit like, you know, blaming the Red Cross for starting World War I. I mean, the World Bank really is trying to reduce poverty, not entrench it. And the people who go and work there are extremely qualified people who could have gone to work for somebody else, Goldman Sachs or McKinsey or some other high-flying job. But they actually want to get into a C-130 transport aircraft and fly into a war zone in Bosnia to help reconstruction there. Or they want to go to Africa and get a well into a village or help out with malnutrition in Southeast Asia. I mean, they, you know, that's why they do this job. But you're right that this question of corporate interest comes up a lot. And I went to Chad, this big landlocked country in Central Africa bordering on Sudan, where you now have this genocide going on. And I looked in detail at one example where the World Bank was arguably in cahoots with big corporate interests.
This was the oil pipeline, right?
Yeah, that's right. There's, you know, ExxonMobil was building, developing oil in southern Chad, and it needed to build a big pipeline to go through, which would go through a rainforest where pygmies were still living. There was obviously great environmental sensitivity as well as social sensitivity about the indigenous people there. And the World Bank was backing this project. And so a lot of groups, like the Environmental Defense Fund, got extremely upset and protested the bank again and accused the bank of all kinds of nefarious conspiracy with ExxonMobil. And it's true that ExxonMobil, I mean, it's a profit-making corporation. It's not, you know, out to save the world. Its incentive is basically just to get the oil out and make some money. And so this is sort of a test case of the point you're raising. But the fact is that the bank's influence on that project was to insist that ExxonMobil do a 19-volume environmental and social impact study to figure out precisely how to make this pipeline in a way that would not disrupt the wildlife as it went through, that would not disrupt the indigenous people that it went through, that would be sensitive to biodiversity and so on. And they oversaw the implementation of this, the building of this pipeline, in a way which was much better than it would have been without the World Bank's involvement.
One of the things that James Wolfensohn did was, in October of 1996, he denounced what he called the cancer of corruption in third world development. You've made the point that one of the things that Wolfensohn and others have learned is that the World Bank can help a country when it's determined and committed to help itself. This raised the issue of how you deal with a country steeped in corruption. What was the significance of the president of a World Bank taking this issue on?
Well, he really shattered a taboo with that speech in 1996, because before then, the World Bank's view had been that it couldn't denounce corruption in developing countries because that would be political. And its mandate, its charter, was basically supposed to be an economic and banking institution, not a political one. But what happened is that during the 1980s, when the World Bank essentially focused on getting economic policy right, on allowing prices to dictate where resources flowed, balancing budgets, killing hyperinflation, a decade or more of that did not really lift most of the poor world out of poverty. It didn't work in Africa. You needed to do more than just the economics. You had to think about the politics, because if the political institutions were rotten and corrupt, then nobody could invest, and you wouldn't get growth, and you wouldn't get anywhere. And Wolfensohn saw this. He sort of saw it instinctively, and it went back to early trips he'd made as a young businessman to Nigeria in 1960, where he tried to invest in Nigeria and was immediately confronted with ministers who demanded bribes from him. And he was actually briefly detained by the police in the 60s and accused of being a spy in Nigeria because, for one reason or another, he had put his foot wrong. So he understood that if you want development, you need to have countries where people can come and invest and not have their money stolen, and that means dealing with corruption. So he put that on the table, and I know people at the World Bank who were advising him before, you can't say this. And he would say, I'm the president of the World Bank, I'll say what I want. And he was quite right.
Wolfensohn has been at the bank now for several years. He's in his 70s. What do you think his priorities and lasting impact will be?
I think the lasting impact of Wolfensohn's tenure will be to transform the bank into an institution that is more keen to listen to people in the poor world, not to dictate development policy to them, but rather to ask them what they regard as their priorities. And to support that sort of stance, he has decentralized the bank, so he's moved people out of headquarters in Washington and located them in the field so that they're closer to the client. And he's instituted a policy of reaching out to non-governmental groups as well as people in government and trying to get input from all sides about what the right development policy ought to be. So it's a more open world bank and a less sort of ideological one.
And what are the major project or projects on the World Bank's agenda now?
I think the major thing on the bank's agenda for the next 5 to 10 years is to figure out a way of playing this middleman position between, on the one hand, the poor countries that want to borrow from the bank, and on the other hand, the rich governments in the north, and also the rich non-governmental groups, the activist groups on the environment and other things like that, which want to use the bank to press their agenda for the developing world, their agenda on the environment, their agenda on the rights of indigenous peoples, which aren't actually always the same as what the majority of people living in the poor world want. And so there's a sort of tension. Is the World Bank going to be the secretariat for the North's ambitions, or is it sort of going to be a service organization for the world's poorest nations?
Well, Sebastian Malaby, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Writer Sebastian Malaby. His new book is The World's Banker.